All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship and continue on here, dealing with verses 12 and 13. We're down to about point 24, in which we've dealt with the fact that Solomon will betray himself, not unwittingly, of course, but knowingly, by this use of the verb yada, to figure out, to know, to recognize, to understand. Which tells you something about what he really believed. And his belief system, of course, included the primary idea that God was far beyond man's comprehension, and that God was to be honored and feared, and that people ought not to resort to evil in order to advance themselves. So point 24, we're ready to move on here. It should be evident that Solomon believed far more than these things. And he expresses some of his beliefs by means of the imperatives he directs towards his younger audience. This is one way of telling you what a person believes when they issue authoritative commands with respect to what you're supposed to be doing. It means that they believe that this is the way it should be. And so these imperatives here also reflect not only what he tells you directly, I know thus and such, obviously, that's one way of knowing what people know. But another way of knowing here is through these imperatives that he directs towards these readers. One should be respectful towards God. As he warned people to guard your steps as you draw near to the house of God. The important thing being, of course, to come there to listen with the recognition that you are there to learn in terms of God and his plan. And listen rather than to be too quick to talk or to be too quick to go through overt rituals that don't really address internal issues. B, one should fulfill his obligations. This is in the vow situation here. Of course, Solomon was a believer that one should not vow as he says this. Don't let your speech get you in trouble. You're better off not to vow than to vow and not pay. But vows, as we pointed out when we covered this, were never an imperative in the Old Testament. They were always personal choices. They weren't commands. And so one could obligate oneself or not. And Solomon suggests that one, you're better off if you obligate yourself to fulfill it. Verse 4, when you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it. For he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. That a person, we might say, so I mean, you could even reduce this further, to a person ought to be good for their word. If they give their word about something, they ought to follow through with it. Particularly, of course, as it relates to God and religious obligations. C, one should fear God. This imperative is in 5:7. Rather fear God, and we'll see it again in 12:13. Fear God and keep his commandments. D, one should carefully ponder the work of God, that there is a time and a place for careful consideration with the recognition that things that are happening, things that have happened, are the work of God. In some ways, the way the world is. Solomon attributes to the work of God, as he says here, who is able to straighten what he has bent. And a part of that, considering the work of God in verse 13 there, is carried on in verse 14, where one ought to seriously consider that there are days of adversity, or rather there are days of prosperity. There are days of adversity too, but prosperity here is the first one. Point D here, or point E, one should enjoy whatever prosperity God provides. In the day of prosperity, be happy. Solomon did not believe, his belief system did not include some sort of ascetic bent that said, you know, look, even if God provides you good things, he doesn't want you to enjoy them. And again, that was some of the idea that came through particularly American culture in the last 50 to 100 years, is that there's this sort of old poor boy, poor mouth sort of approach to life. That even if God blesses you with something, don't act like he did. Don't let anyone know. Then they might expect something from you. No. God says if you've got prosperity, Solomon says it, in the day of prosperity, be happy. If you're not going to be happy in the day of prosperity, you're going to have a tough time at other times. And a part of the balance of life is, again, enjoying the happiness that God provides as he provides it. But this also acknowledges, hey, God provides the day of prosperity. I'm not out trying to crank it up. And 9:7, which we haven't got there yet, but we will see here. Go then. Eat your bread in happiness, and drink your wine with a cheerful heart. For God has already approved your works. And so there's a sense in which, and this is a this statement really throws interpreters, because here Solomon point blank just flat out tells you that God is for the positive believer, that God is for the person that wants to do it right, and that it isn't a matter of, oh, it's up in the air, maybe God's for me, maybe he's not. He tells his younger audience, God is for you. And again, we're assuming that his younger audience is reading this because they want wisdom. They're obviously are joining themselves at some level to that wisdom tradition in Israel, as expressed through Solomon. And that there's a sense in which, of course, the positive believer is under the approbation of God, and the negative believer is not, and the unbeliever is not. But that fact does exist, and that is a reality that people need to know. So one should enjoy whatever prosperity God provides, and one should also recognize that God sends adversity. Back to 7:14, but in the day of adversity. Think about it. You're going to have good days, you're going to have bad days, you're going to have hard times. Some may last days, weeks, months, you never know. And whenever God sends one, God sends the other. And God has made the one as well as the other. So ideally, of course, you know, as you approach life, we'd all like to have prosperity and blessing and happiness at all times. But life doesn't work that way. And God creates adversity. And it creates adversity for our own good at some level. And that has to be one of the understandings, that God is, again, benevolent. So if he's sending adversity, there must be a reason behind it. And we may not, again, always know what that reason is. May not ever figure it out. One should be obedient to the king. Again, Solomon would counsel his belief system is that the establishment chain of command is there for a reason. And he sort of alluded to that earlier in the book, that in spite of the problems with the establishment chain of command, as he summed it up there in 5:9, as he makes this statement about oppression and all of that and denial of justice, one might be inclined to adopt an anarchist attitude then. We don't need no stinking government. We don't need any authority. We'll be laws to ourselves. And Solomon counters that with, no, there's a real advantage to having a king. That there is, for whatever flaws that the establishment chain of command has, we're better off with it than without it. That's a part of his belief system. That one is better off with a good government, even with a bad government, than no government at all. And while many people have bemoaned just the opposite or claimed the opposite, no government is better than bad government. No, it's not. It's not Solomon's belief. It's not my belief. And so people that want to throw off authorities, throw off governments, and become laws to themselves, guess what? They're idiots. They're anarchists and idiots. And Solomon's not for them. He's not for that at any level. So they're at odds with, you know, of course, much of the Bible. One should honor and enjoy marriage. We haven't gotten to that one yet, but again, some of these I've here as we deal with these imperatives. Enjoying life is actually the verb ra'ah, to see life, to observe it, to experience it. And really, experience life may be a better translation here. I don't have any problem with the fact that enjoyment is part of it. With the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given you under the sun. And the irony here is Solomon doesn't counsel enjoying life with women. Now we got Solomon advocating monogamy? Holy crap. How did that happen? Here's a guy married to 700 women, 300 concubines, advocating monogamy? Well, yes. I think a part of Solomon's belief system was the recognition that monogamy was the divine intention. And that that was the way it was to be. Solomon wasn't confused by this in spite of his own weaknesses and failures. And you should recognize that in your own life. You may have areas of weakness and failure, things you do you wish you didn't do, or you fail in areas where you wish you didn't, but you do. But at a certain level, you don't let that affect your viewpoint and your thinking. Okay, I fail. I'm not going to completely cut God loose from my life just because I fail. And so here one should honor and enjoy marriage, enjoy life with the woman you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given to you under the sun. For this is your reward in life. A part of the phase two niche is this enjoyment in marriage, the divine institution that God established. And I'm fully convinced, in spite of Solomon's weaknesses, he recognized that God established the divine institution. He knew what it was. He wasn't stupid. He may have failed in that area. But Solomon, the great thing I see here is, one, he doesn't let his failures cause him to articulate some weird viewpoint. His failures don't stop him from articulating the viewpoint of one man and one woman. He didn't say, get a bunch of them, get a harem. I mean, he could have given all kinds of commands here. One should be diligent in his work, whatever your hand finds to do. Do it with all your might. One should do his work in chapter 9 there, verse 10, in a way that reflects the fact that life is fleeting. And you better do it up now, because the day's coming, as Jesus put it in another way. The night is coming when no man can work. And Jesus was referring to the inevitability of death. Just as Solomon refers to here, for there is no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol. In this case, in this context, Sheol is to be viewed as a synonym here for the grave. When you go to the grave, you're not going to be doing anything in that box. I mean, using modern burial methods. You're not going to be in there planning or scheming or working or doing anything. You're going to be dead. And so he uses that as an impetus again, death as an impetus now for functioning properly in life. J, one should be charitable and diversify since the future is uncertain. Chapter 11, verses 1 and 2. And I haven't gotten to these verses yet, so I mean, I just kind of, this is my assessment of kind of what they're saying, but I reserve the right to change this once I get into them. But cast your bread on the water, on the surface of the waters. And you will find it after many days. It's going to be soggy, but you'll find it. Well, obviously he doesn't mean literal bread here. Clearly he's talking in a sense that we would not understand as literal. So what's he getting at? Divide your portion to 7 or 8. Sounds like to me the cast your bread in some ways is charity. Dividing your portion is diversifying. And so both are good advice in these uncertain times in which we live. You do not know what a misfortune may occur on the earth. You may be invested in one thing, but if you're invested in 8, the odds are all 8 of them going south at once aren't probably going to happen. But then again, that can happen. You just never know. That's the whole point, is life is uncertain. And so how do we approach life since life is so uncertain? K, one should work hard since the future is uncertain. Verse 6. Again, Solomon does not counsel, I don't think we have an imperative, well, we kind of do, but he does not counsel idleness or laziness. In spite of the fact that people abuse all kinds of things, but particularly there, as he said, you know, people in a rivalry, they do this and that, they try to one-up people, all right, well, one might suggest, well, then don't do anything. No, Solomon doesn't counsel that. Sow your seed in the morning. And do not be idle in the evening, for you do not know whether the morning or evening sowing will succeed, or whether both of them alike will be good. But if one of them fails, well, you've got your bases covered by sowing in the evening. If both of them succeed, well, you're still money ahead. The odds of both of them failing from Solomon's perspective here seem to be minute. That doesn't seem to be an issue. Now, obviously they could, but I don't think he's suggesting that. I think he's saying that if you're conscientious about things, that it's going to work to your advantage. The conscientious believer gets blessed. One should enjoy the fleeting time of youth. Ecclesiastes 11, 9 and 10. Rejoice, young man, during childhood. And again, from what I see here, back about the verse about enjoy, his target audience is not only younger, it's male. That doesn't mean women couldn't read this and prosper from it. And profit from it. But his argument largely is aimed at young men, probably his son first, and then a broader range of that generation. But these things are true of, you know, should young women rejoice and enjoy their youth? Yeah, you might as well, because it's going to go by pretty fast. Again, once you hit 35, you're on the downhill slide. That's the midpoint. Now, I know, but, you know, and again, people's idea of old changes as you get older. You know, it was funny. I was watching Pete Townsend the other day. He said for a long time they wouldn't sing My Generation. They went years without singing that song because to them it seemed ludicrous. Hope I die before I get old. Now they sing it recognizing that it's ludicrous. Well, we're old and we haven't died yet. We're 65, still up here. You should be on Social Security, man. And you're up, you know, you're up there. Well, they're doing what they like, I guess. So the young days go by fast during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of young manhood. And follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes. Yet know that God will bring you to judgment for all these things. And this also tells you that, hey, look, God has to be the first priority, but use your youth wisely, because it's going to go by fast. And this sounds to me, again, very much like the advice you would expect from an older, wiser guy, that you figure out. When you're young, of course, time seems endless. I mean, like I said before, the summer vacation, the 3 months, it was like it was never going to end when you were, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. And yet, then school always started, and there you go. But those days go by fast. The days of youth, agility, stamina, all of that begins to decline as you get older. And at very most, you can maybe hinder it. You can't stop it. You might be able to slow it momentarily, but you're never going to stop it, and you sure aren't going to reverse it. I love these ads. Reverse the effects of aging. How do I do that? I don't think you can. But it makes for a good ad copy and all that. So enjoy the fleeting time of youth, verse 10, and also remove grief and anger from your heart. And put away pain from your body, because childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. Solomon believed that young people should live their lives, but they should live them with a certain resignation at that level, knowing that God's in charge of it and that they're going to be accountable to God. But they should also live it with a certain gusto. Go out there and do it. This is an imperative. Follow the impulses of your heart. Follow your heart when you're young. And guess what? The only thing you better know is the heart is deceitfully wicked above all else. Who can understand it? You better know something about the heart. The hearts of the sons of men are fully given to do evil in light of the fact that punishment is not always administered. Evil and insanity resides in the heart. Solomon tells you all this. So he says, follow your evil, insane heart, but be careful, because you've got to recognize God is going to judge you for this. So I think this is sound advice. I mean, at some level, once youth is over, you know, we were talking about that last night, you know, as you get older, you get more set in your ways, you get more, you know, you have a certain schedule you adhere to regularly. I find that as I get older, I don't, even taking vacations is a challenge, because I don't like getting off my schedule. And when you're on vacation, well, then you're at the mercy of every idiot out there, apparently, unfortunately. Well, one should make God a priority before old age. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth. Remember here isn't just, you know, oh, I remember there's a God. It's to think about it, to reflect on it, to ponder, to give it some consideration. What is another impetus for living life in the here and now? Old age. Guess what happens when you get older? Things start to break down. The body breaks down. Again, you can go to the gym, you can exercise, you can do certain things, keep your stamina up, balance, agility, these sorts of things. But I find myself more and more, if I'm out in public shopping or doing whatever I'm doing, you know, I'm out there and I see people, you know, you watch these little old people. And, you know, little old people are like white hair and they're in front of you, you know, you're thinking, come on, move. And I keep finding myself thinking, that's going to be you in a few years. It's not that far off for you, you doddering old fool. And so, guess what? It's this is a motivation for living now. Old age is coming. When old age coming, the hearing's going to go. The eyes are going to go. The legs are going to lose their strength. The hands and the arms are going to tremble. Your teeth are going to go. Thank God we got dentists nowadays. Technology's great. Had one go here a while back, and, you know, new cap. So they're pretty much intact still. Well, Solomon didn't have that luxury. I don't know that they did. So again, the eyes go, the hearing goes, your fear sets in, I mean, have you ever watched an old person drive? They're white-knuckling it all the time. Why? Because they're scared. And think, I mean, you know, God, pretend you're 90 now. And how much faster is the world moving now than when these people were 10? Let's see, that'd be 80 years ago, so we're talking about, what, 1928? That was a long time ago. The world was a whole different place. Of course, the world's a real different place for all of us, isn't it? How much has it changed just since you got here? I mean, it's changed dramatically. So, again, one should make God a priority before old age. Don't wait till, oh, I'll give God his due later on. No. Live your life. Live it. Follow your heart, but recognize that God's in it. That you are not just in it for yourself. And then one should learn, one should recognize that studying or learning has its limitations. Ecclesiastes 12:12. Beyond this, my son, be warned. Here's a little friendly advice. And the writing of many books is endless. An excessive devotion to books. And I would change, see, this is in italics there, to books. I think it's the idea of learning. Excessive devotion to knowledge and learning is wearying to the body. You can only learn so much. And let's face it, how much do you really need to know to function into this world? Do you need to understand subatomic physics in order to function in this world? I say no. Do you need to understand quarks and various small particles and how they function and operate? No, I don't think so. Do you need to know about the fake black holes or the real black holes? Are they out there? Who knows? Nobody's ever proved one. So how much do you really need to know to live in this world? At a certain point, knowledge and learning becomes counterproductive. There are people who have, you know, all kinds of degrees after their name. A BA, an MA, a PhD, piled higher and deeper, as we call it. You know, a THM, a Master of Theology, and this and that, and on and on and on. How much do you need to have? How much knowledge do you really need to live in this world? Now, if you work in a specialized environment, obviously knowledge is your ally. If you work in some, obviously, like healthcare, you better know something about healthcare. I don't want to go to the hospital and find someone that says, oh, I didn't need to learn. Knowledge is only so helpful. I'm dying here. You don't want to hear, you know, you're going to have heart surgery or something. Well, I finished last in my class. I would, you know, what I would aspire to. You know, so if you're in some specialized form of work, yes, clearly knowledge has its place, and we know that. Obviously, you can't interpret the Bible without some Greek and Hebrew and isagogics and systematic and all of that. I mean, it requires some knowledge. But after a point, knowledge can become counterproductive. People are obsessed with learning. And what we hear about the last days, always learning, but never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. I think that's what Solomon's getting at here. There's a certain point at which, okay, enough's enough. I don't need to write a bunch of books or read a bunch of books. I've kind of figured out what life is. And very little of my life has to do with great knowledge and book learning. My life has to do with getting to work in fellowship, driving a car, which, you know, you can learn at 15 or 16, although I'm really a big advocate of going back to driver's ed because the people today do not know how to drive. They're largely uninstructed. So, but, you know, my life isn't understanding a bunch of real critical, deep knowledge. It's getting to work, turning on my computer, I push the button. Doesn't require much. Turn on the monitor, turn on the printer. Okay, now here I go. I know how to use a mouse. That's gets me through most of my day, to be honest with you. I don't have, you know, obviously I do other things. I have to know how to use a spreadsheet and banking account programs and all that. But you know what? After a certain point, how much more do you need to learn? You know, I had the other day, one of my boss asked me, you think we ought to go take this advanced class in spreadsheets? No. Not really. But, you know, why? What are we doing here that requires advanced spreadsheet knowledge? Nothing that I know of. So the thing is, again, there's a certain, Solomon would tell people, hey, when you're young, don't wear yourself out with books necessarily. There's a place for learning. We're not against learning. Again, Hosea bemoans the fact that my people perish for lack of knowledge. So again, as you put all this together, you see a guy who has a pretty orthodox view of life. I think it fits with what I understand of life. So 25, all this points to a man that was theologically orthodox, but was not afraid to note the apparent contradictions that pose a challenge to the faith of the positive believer. So Solomon was not one who just glossed over difficult subjects because they were difficult, or they were hard to understand, or they challenged what was conventional wisdom. Solomon looked at it hard. He looked at it with a critical eye, it appears to me. And he was willing to deal with it. And some people aren't. They just want, you know, they want to sugarcoat everything. They like the rose-colored glasses approach to life, the Pollyanna approach. Well, guess what? It isn't all doom and gloom. Then there's the other extreme, of course, doom and gloom. It's all doom and gloom. You know, the kind of believer that goes around, no matter how happy you are, how up, he's got to shoot it down. Because, you know, there's no point in you being happy. You know, you can only be happy so much, so don't be happy at all. Well, okay, that approach is not right either. So you have to sort of, again, you have to figure out a balance here. There are challenges out there. We acknowledge them. Things go badly sometimes. The wicked prosper. The righteous get jammed. Guess what? None of these things change God's plan. They're true, but they don't change God's plan. 26, beyond that, if we are to take the concluding statement about the author seriously, we must consider this book to be appropriate words, which are designed to express the truth correctly, because essentially Solomon tells you this about himself in the third person. Some may have here, see a later hand, adding a postscript to the book. But it's not unusual for Solomon to talk about himself in the third person. He's talked about himself in the first person. The preacher here sought to find delightful words and to write the words of truth correctly. Delightful here, another meaning there is appropriate. That which gets the job done. So why would I conclude that this book was anything but that? I wouldn't. If I understand that Solomon's theologically orthodox, but Solomon's asking and dealing with a lot of the hard questions in life, the challenges to faith. And Solomon says, hey, in spite of all these things, faith still works. Faith is still the way to go. So 27, therefore, the last portion of Ecclesiastes 8:12 indicates that while Solomon recognized the inequities of life and that the wicked could prosper by means of their own evil, he did not believe that one should approach life in that way. And that gets into, again, the reality that people are opportunists. From time to time, if they see a deal, they may take advantage of it. If they see an opportunity, hey, I can get ahead here, they may take advantage of it. And it may be something simple. We've all probably had the experience where you went somewhere, you paid for something, and they gave you too much change. It may be coin change, or maybe they gave you an extra 5 or 10 or whatever. You know, the opportunist just says, hey, it's my money, put it in my pockets, found. The righteous person says, this isn't my money, and returns it. So, again, people can be opportunistic in small ways, they can be opportunistic in big ways, trying to advance themselves. So, again, one should not approach life this way just because it works. And it does work sometimes, let's face it, it does work. People can run scams and schemes and all kinds of things and be successful at it. How many stories do you hear on the news, you know, oh, so-and-so's under indictment because, you know, he took a bunch of money. And there was some, I think last week it was some cruise line or some online internet vacation booking site. They took all these deposits and all this, thousands and thousands of dollars, didn't book any cruises. And these people are out there, whatever there is, they're $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 for their trip. And now they got no trip. Well, this is not unusual. This goes on all the time. I mean, I see stories like this all the time on the news where somebody's scamming people and then they disappear. Well, surprise, surprise. Well, 28, instead, he directly and clearly states his belief that in the long term, it was better to have a fear of God, in spite of the temporary success that evil, wickedness, and oppression might bring to those that resort to it. In 29, he states that those that fear God will ultimately find that their lot will be one that is characterized by good. Now, back to the original question. Who knows what is good for a man in this life? Who knows what is good for you? I don't. God does. And he says, I know ultimately that good comes to those who fear God. And that implies, obviously, that means humbling yourself under his mighty hand, accepting the niche that he has provided for you, and functioning in all of that, and doing it honorably. Well, 30, the noun tov, good, is used in the following ways in the New Testament. It's used to practical, economic, or material good, i.e. prosperity, 1 Kings 10:7. Here is the Queen of Sheba giving her assessment of Solomon's condition to Solomon. That she said, "It's a true report I've heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom." Verse 6. "Nevertheless, I did not believe the reports until I came and my eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. You exceed in wisdom and good the report that I heard." They've translated by the term prosperity because they understand it here, that it's not just his wisdom, but it's the material blessings that attended that kingdom, the grandeur of it. And that it was something. It was majestic to see. And so much so that she was, as it says, there was no spirit left in her. This just blew her away. I mean, she was just completely overwhelmed by all this. She'd never seen anything like it. And she was royalty herself, so it wasn't as though she was used to living in humble circumstances or anything like that. She was no doubt from a royal family, and she was enjoying all the perks and benefits that being the queen brought you, but nothing like what Solomon had. And by the material prosperity, I don't just mean the money he had and all of that, but the nature of his provision each day, which of course involved thousands and thousands of dollars worth of food, just food, that was there to feed the court and to deal with all that. And the way his staff conducted themselves, there was some real decorum. It was no doubt spit and polished. Everything was just the way it should be. And this was impressive to see. So B, it's also used of that which is useful or beneficial. Genesis 2:9, where we see the creation of the trees. "Out of the ground the Lord God caused to grow every tree that is pleasing to the sight and good for food." Good for a specific purpose here. Good, beneficial, we might say, for food. And it's also seen there in 1 Samuel 19:4. So the word good, again, is a general term, and it's used in a broad number of ways. Then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, "Do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very," they've translated beneficial here, which is the idea of it, good for you. David's activity had not in any way undermined Saul. David was a loyal and faithful subject to the king, in spite of the various things that happened. See, abstract good that brings pleasure, such as beauty, good wine, food, etc. These are things that are abstract quality. I mean, obviously, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, we might say. But one person, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure. But these abstract concepts of good that we deem like beauty and all that. Genesis 6:2, the sons of God, the angelic infiltrators, the fallen angels, or a portion of the fallen angels, not all of them, saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. The word beautiful, there's a translation of tov, good. And the idea was that they were attractive. And they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. And also 1 Samuel 6, 16:12. So you have, again, a broad range of ways this word can be used. So he brought him in to him, or he sent and brought him in, and he was ruddy. Here's David, redhead, with beautiful eyes, good eyes is the idea, and a handsome appearance. So the idea here is that David was an attractive guy. I mean, he was a redheaded guy, probably had freckles. I understand, you know, the nature of most redheads. And David may not have looked like what people had, you know, expected him to look like. But he was, of course, we might say handsome. That's another way of, again, abstract things are good. D, quality, value, a good can get into that which is expensive or costly. Genesis 2:12. Where it talks about the four rivers that a river flowed out of Egypt, Eden, and divided into four. And then in verse 12, the gold of that land is good. Good here, meaning with the idea of expensive, costly, pricey. It's probably more pure than gold in other areas. And in that case, pure might even be a good translation of it, because the purer it is, as we know, the more valuable it is. It's also used of moral goodness, as one might expect. People can be good, they can do good. Psalm 34:14, right? And so when we talk about he's a good man, we're not talking about, you know, his wealth or any of that. We're talking about his moral qualities, his character, his integrity. Psalm 34:14, depart from evil and do good. Good in that context would have to do with righteousness, doing the right thing, that which is acceptable morally, rather than just, you know, general good, we might say. It's a moral good. F, it is used in comparisons with the idea of better than. We've seen that in Ecclesiastes regularly. Use good, the noun there, coupled with the preposition men. Which means to be good from something means to be something is better than something. So we see that it's used in comparisons there, Ecclesiastes 4:6. He uses a number. I just cited one here. There's a bunch of them. One handful of rest is better than two fists full of labor. There's a point at which appropriate rest, again, beats excessive labor. You can only work so much. It's good to have a good work ethic. It's good to know when to take a day off and have a vacation, too. All work and no play makes us all dull, boys, not just Jack. Makes all of us dull. You need a break. You need time off from time to time. Doesn't mean you have to go somewhere. You don't have to spend $80 million to go do it. But you can do that, too, if you have it, if you have $80 million. I don't know where you're going to go spend that kind of money. Dubai! You're keeping up with what's going on over there. Yeah, oil's helping us, isn't it? Certainly helping them. The idiom G, good in one's eyes, is used to express intention or desire. Genesis 19:8. It's the first book in one of the Testaments. Genesis 19:8. Here, of course, is where a good old Lot, trying to save the angels from getting raped. Behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with men. I'll give you my two virgin daughters. Well, homos aren't interested in virgin women. Surprise, surprise. That's not their deal. They may want to shoe shop with them, maybe. I don't know. But they're not interested in them sexually. They hate women. That's a problem with homosexuals. They hate women. All homosexuals hate women. There's not an exception to that rule. They have some major mental problems in addition to the spiritual and moral problems they have. They hate women. Oh, well, they hang out with women. Yeah. They may, but they're not going to sleep with them, trust me. And so here, new daughters, bring them out and let do whatever is good in your eyes, literally as it says. Whatever you like, whatever you're inclined to do. What a dad. Well, this is Lot, though, in his spiritual decline, as he has chosen the path of this world, the path of least resistance. And how's it working out for him? Not too well. And it gets worse. This isn't the low point of Lot's life yet, offering his virgin daughters to an insane mob of homos. Well, you think, and it gets worse? Yeah, it gets worse. So 31, in passages where the term is used with an impersonal verb, as it is here, it is used to describe a state of happiness, well-being, and contentment. And now that may involve a lot of things we might call good. Like you might have good food in that niche. You might have a lot of money in that niche. You might have the blessings of certain details in that niche. That might be a part of that. But for a man or a woman, basically, any human, to the extent that you're happy and content, do you want much more than that? Do you really need much more than that? I mean, isn't that often enough? So 32, Solomon affirms his belief that those that live in the fear of God will find that they are blessed, in spite of examples and temporal evidence to the contrary. Now, this doesn't mean that they won't have struggles, that they won't face challenges. This doesn't mean that they won't be tested. This just means that ultimately, if a person fears God, those who live in fear before him, ultimately God's going to work things for good. But we get the same New Testament doctrine in Romans 8:28. We know that God causes all things to work together for good. And he uses, again, the Hebrew, the Greek equivalent there. God causes all things to work together on behalf of good for the believer. Now, not all things are good. We're not saying that. But what appears again on the surface, or you probably can think back over your Christian life, and at some point you can think of something that on the surface, it appeared bad at the time. It was hard, it was difficult, it was troubling, it was a real pressure on you. And then after you got through it and all, now you see down the road there was a long-term benefit in there that you didn't see at the time. You're glad that it worked out the way it did. Although at the time it was going on, you might not have said that. You might not have said, oh, I'm just happy, this is great. No, I don't like it, I don't understand this, I don't know why this is happening. But God has some long-term benefit that we didn't see. And the long-term benefits, this is the thing with doctrine. Very often, now see, God tests people. He tested the Hebrew believers. He tests all believers. And he said, you have need of endurance, that after having done the will of God, you may obtain what was promised. Yes, but you're going to have to go through the endurance factors and the endurance test and having done the will of God and continuing to run when, again, at the last days, everything is set against us. Our unseen enemies are set against us. They work on us at all times to make us casualties, to infiltrate our thinking. The visible enemies out there, the cosmos, they're set against us. They're not in favor of the positive believer. Even negative believers are set against you. They're really not for you. There's a certain hostility and animosity that exists between positive and negative believers, unfortunately. We're in the same family, but there's no regard there. I have no regard for people that are negative. I don't look at them and think, oh, I'd like to hang out with you. No, I would rather assume a position with the lowliest of the positive than with the highest of the negative. I'm not interested. And what am I going to talk to them about? Well, let's discuss doctrine. What about Solomon? What do you think about his view of Ecclesiastes? First, most people couldn't intelligently discuss this book to save their lives. And I mean, it's a challenging book. I'm not in any way, trying to say that it's not. It is. But to be able to discuss it intelligently, and what are we going to talk about? The doctrine of U.S. and prophecy? Most believers don't want to hear that. Oh, by the way, what are we going to talk about? The last days, the lukewarm syndrome, the Laodicean church that permeates almost everything? No, they don't want to hear about that, especially if they're in one. So why would they want to hear about that? So again, you're going to find, Solomon affirms here, that there may be temporal examples or temporal evidence to the contrary from time to time, but ultimately, long term, his view in the big picture is God blesses those who fear him. Verse 13 continues here with the thought that those who fear God will be blessed by introducing the opposite type of person who does not fear God. And 34, while some have suggested that this verse contradicts what he has just acknowledged in 12a, the fact is that this verse is designed to affirm his belief, in spite of the fact that some people are successful in prolonging their places, careers, and lives. And as we were discussing on break, as Pete pointed out, we had this discussion before, that the wicked and the righteous are the two extremes in this factor. You have the wicked man, who we would say, from the human perspective at any rate, you would think, even the doctrinal perspective, the wicked man should never prosper. And the righteous man should prosper and should not be jammed. That would be our view of it. That God is for the righteous and he's against the wicked. And yet we see wicked men prospering. And then out here you have sort of the middle ground. And these people are loosely referred to as the sinners. And they may not go out for full-blown wickedness. Most people don't. Most people try to maintain some level of what they perceive to be acceptability. What is acceptable? How can I get by? How can I be accepted by people? Now, I don't want to go to this extreme over here and be righteous. No. Don't want to make all the sacrifices that the righteous have to make. Not going to fear God at that level. I'm not going to get in Bible class. I'm not going to get in a sound church. I'm not going to pay the price. I'm going to do it my way. Well, but for most people out here, if they go to church or they acknowledge God, they're acceptable with people. They're not ostracized big time. Not normally. And then on the other hand, they may not be willing to go to this extreme over here. They may not have the criminal mentality that says, to hell with everybody, I'm going to get mine. And if I have to kill you to do it, I'm willing to do that. Most people aren't like that. Most people fall out here somewhere in this big morass of in-betweenness, we might say, for lack of a better term. And so the sinners, they may be opportunistic. They may say, hey, I can do this and get ahead. Boop, boop, boop. There I go. And, I can cheat on my taxes here. I can save an extra $100, and there you go. So they might do that. Now, it doesn't mean that they're going to go out and cheat every day. They may just take that one opportunity and do it. Or it may mean they figure out ways to cheat, and they cheat all the time. But if they continue to do that, they're going to end up over here at some point. Where most people, they have a conscience, a pitiful, pathetic example of a conscience, but a conscience nonetheless. Because their conscience justifies them in their stupid activities. And it justifies them in their negative volition. It justifies them in their lukewarm status. And it justifies them so that they feel like they're okay. Well, guess what? My position is, I believe the Bible's position is, you're not okay unless you fear God. And the only way I'm going to know you fear God is you're going to manifest it by certain overt activities. It's going to be evident that you fear God. As James said, hey, you're positive. Show me your faith without your works. I'll show you my faith by my works. So if there isn't a certain amount of level of overt compliance with what I know to be the revealed will of God, and a certain amount of overt applications as people have opportunity, well, guess what? You're missing the boat as far as righteousness. So again, here the extreme would be, we would think the wicked should never prosper, but yet sometimes they do. So again, he's not contradicting himself. He's just saying that some people are successful. You can take these little shortcuts in life, doctrinal shortcuts, we might call them, and guess what? Sometimes they work. They don't always fail. So, should we counsel you to take these shortcuts? No. In fact, I counsel you not to. 35, the wicked man who misses the mark and resorts to evil to advance himself. We'll find that in the long run, he will not enjoy the happiness and contentment which he has pursued apart from the will of God. And at a certain level, even the sinner, those out there, say we might say, in the middle ground, they may do this, but are they really happy deep down? If you could really interview people and get them to tell you the truth, if you could interview even your family members, people that you know that are negative at a certain point, and if they really told you the truth, deep down, I think most of them would admit they're not happy. But they cover it with a facade. A facade of activity, a facade of happiness, a facade that God's for me, and I don't need to do anything different or better. They come to, you know, kind of believe their own BS, which unfortunately is sad, but they do. They begin to believe their own rationalizations. And that's the only form of happiness that they have, I think, at some level. I mean, obviously, good things can happen to them. They can be happy momentarily. I'm talking about long-term, deep-seated contentment, which most people don't have. So 36, in spite of overt appearances, Solomon recognizes that God is not for the evil man. Therefore, any blessing or apparent prosperity does not come from the hand of God. So this brings up the question, do wicked men and even sinners sometimes prosper and claim that it's God's blessing? Of course they do. But does that make it so? Once again, you can crawl in an oven and call yourself a biscuit all day long. But that doesn't make it so. I'm going to hang out a shingle that says I do brain surgery on my house. Brain surgery, reduced rates. It doesn't make me a brain surgeon just because I say I am. Just because some jackass forces his way into the ministry doesn't mean he was called or that God the Holy Spirit was in it. I've seen this, and yet people claim this all the time. They make these outlandish claims. And then if you challenge them, why, what's wrong with you? You're just narrow-minded. Yeah, narrow-minded enough to believe that you have to do it God's way. I am that narrow-minded. That if you ultimately want to succeed, you got to do it God's way. And that's the challenge. Some people, they want to succeed, but they're not willing to pay the price that it takes to succeed. Once again, athletic analogies are perfect for this. It's just Manny being Manny. See, Manny doesn't want to do what it takes to succeed. Manny doesn't want to run out the infield hit. Manny doesn't want to run full speed when he's chasing the ball in the outfield. Manny wants to wear his hair down to his butt and get paid millions of dollars, but he's not willing to really pay the price of what it takes to be a great top-notch athlete. And who wants to pay the price? Well, guess what? Pretend you want to be a Buccaneer. You know where you are today, don't you? You're in Orlando out there sweating, doing full tilt workouts in full pads. And for women, I don't know, maybe most of the guys here have, but if you've ever put on a full football outfit, the helmet, the pads, all of it, you come to realize that, you know, that's a significant amount of weight you're carrying. And it does slow you down. And can you imagine carrying that weight in the 105-degree heat index that they'll be facing today, most likely, and all that? But you know why they're doing it? Because they're willing to pay the price. They're willing to do what it takes now to play in January. And that's why they're out there in August in the middle of Florida and all that. And so, and one advantage it has, you know, at least for the Buccaneers, you know, these people, these teams come down from Chicago and New York and all that, and they have to play them in the heat here. Believe me, they're not used to that. They work out in the other environment altogether. So, again, people can claim their prosperity, their blessing is coming from God. My contention is if you're not doing it God's way, if you're not doing it out of the fear of God, then it's not coming from God. So where's it coming from? Well, let's face it. Can't people prosper themselves? I've seen believers do that. Can't people go out and make it work, as it were? And let's face it. Doesn't Satan have some agenda behind all this that we might imagine, in which if he's going to take people captive and neutralize them, the best way to make you feel good in the prison camp is to make you comfortable. And the more comfortable you are in the prison camp, the less likely you are to escape. Okay, well, I wanted to get through this, but I didn't quite make it. Our time's gone, so we will stop here and continue on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying these things. May God, the Holy Spirit, enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.